Support for this public radio podcast comes from Pabst Brewing, supporting live music and local artists nationwide, and proud supporter of NPR Music Podcasts at PabstBlueRibbon.com.
Think of that guy you only bump into every now and then. You recognize his face when he walks up to you. Takes a minute maybe to come up with the name and remember exactly where you know him from. You vaguely recall things he said, roughly what kind of person he is. Maybe you're thinking, you know, I might like to get to know this guy. And for all you know, he's thinking the same thing. But circumstances just don't make it possible. Well, in a way, we are that guy. And the relationship is about to change. I'm Jeff Horwich. I host a show called In the Loop. For many of you, that name probably has kind of a vaguely familiar ring to it, right? For the past year, we've been on Minnesota Public Radio once a month. We've made some good, close friends in that time. But to most of you, we're probably like that guy you run into randomly every now and then at a party or on your lunch break. Starting this week, though, we'll have a brand new In the Loop for you every 7 days. We're going to record them with our studio audience here at Minnesota Public Radio. You're invited, of course. It's an experiment, as all new shows are, and it will last for about 2 months. But before we jump in, before we take our relationship to the next level, we have today, this hour, to get reacquainted a little bit. Think of it like a guided tour. It's our chance to share how we think, the kinds of things we like to do on the radio, and a little bit about how our show works. For you, it's a chance to see whether you want this new friend in your life. And to learn how you can get involved and help us build each show with your stories and ideas. That collaboration is a huge part of what In the Loop is all about. We are talking constantly with our network of listeners to help illuminate the topic we choose for each week's show. We interview them for our stories, we bring you their commentaries, we engage them in conversation from our studio audience, and we want to capture their creativity and talent. Now, one of our favorite examples of listener contributions is from back in March in a show we called Are You Your Job? First up is Carrie McDonald. And Carrie, what do you do for a living?
I am a sales and use tax auditor for the state of Minnesota.
That sounds fascinating. What an awesome... No, really, that's kind of a boring job, isn't it? Right? People, I mean, like, it's hard to get people psyched about that.
It is sometimes, you bet.
But, you know, when we read your poem and the way that you conceive of your auditor job, you know, my producer and I both had the same thought about what we can add to it just to spice it up a little bit. Kind of a sound texture from our band, if they'll help us out. A little something like this. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That says auditor to me, I think. Anyway, you'll see in a moment what we're thinking here. Let me introduce Carrie McDonald, state tax auditor.
Not by choice, but rather by submission. Here I come, and I don't get a commission.
Auditor, 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 auditor.
When I call, you will wish that you were dreaming. But oh no, too soon you may be screaming.
Auditor, auditor, auditor.
With abacus, I stress over your books. What a mess! Next, I must deliver news which shall make you quiver.
Auditor, 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 auditor.
A few years back, we changed the rules on you. Now you owe with penalty and interest too. Please have a nice day now. Compliance is no fun. I wish I could have helped you instead of made you stunned.
Auditor, auditor, auditor.
But auditor, I am auditor, the auditor.
Auditor, 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 auditor. Everybody, an auditor for the state of Minnesota. See, being an auditor is awesome. I don't know what you guys all were thinking. Next up, we have Gabe Heller. Now, what job were you doing at the time when you wrote this song you're going to do for us tonight?
I was working security at the airport, so I was checking people's shoes and looking in their bags a lot.
So you're all wearing the same uniform, mm-hmm. right? You got a zillion rules to follow in that job. How do you put some of yourself into it?
Well, you open up that little box where you locked your nosy neighbor in yourself in at a young age, and you let them out on a very strict leash.
Well, this is what that song is about. Kind of a cool way of Gabe, you know, really getting into his job, mm-hmm. working security at the airport. Gabe Heller, everyone.
People collide at the airport. The rich run right into the poor. What if you work there? You've got maybe 30 seconds to try to even up the score. Some folks, they swoon when the football team comes through. Some folks just do their job professional style. Some folks treat those bigwigs just like they're spoiled children. Me, I just mouth off with a smile. One day I saw Prince at the airport, but I did not bow down before him. No, no, no. No, I just asked him if I could see his ticket. He just looked at me like, Maybe there's one man left in Minnesota who doesn't know exactly who I am. Maybe that's why he made just one more good album. You never know, you never know. Last year I checked Jessica Simpson's purse, but I did not treat her like edits, no. No, I just chatted with her like the girl next door as I sorted through her bits. Maybe that's why she got all serious and stuff. Went out to Washington, D.C. to get some credible causes underneath that stylish belt. Maybe it was all because of me. People collide at the airport, yes they do. The rich run right into the poor. Whoa. And if you're lucky, you've got maybe 20 seconds to try to even up the score.
Thank you.
That's Gabe Heller. Last in our group, we've got Alan Staples here. Now, Alan, your take is a little bit different than these other folks. You didn't try to inject some passion into your dull job, right?
No, I think that would be impossible to.
We really appreciated your way of thinking about this issue, and you have an essay, I think, that really speaks for itself. So I'll let you take it from here. Alan Staples.
Sigmund Freud said, "All one needs in life is love and work." Clearly, old Sigmund never had to work retail. I do. And let me tell you, the two just do not mix. During 2 years with my girlfriend, I've had two jobs. One we refer to as my real job. One that I liked, had some responsibility, made decent money, but also worked long hours. And I will admit, at the end of those six-day work weeks, sometimes I would be, well, challenged, shall we say, to have a good time. And then in a flight of artistic fancy, I quit that job. To pay the bills, I started working at a department store. And somewhere along the line, as the stress of responsibility gave way to the grind of mindless tedium, our relationship got really good. Instead of my life revolving around work, it began revolving around the things I love: my girlfriend, my writing, and the Minnesota Twins. And the truth is, after another day spent in my workplace purgatory, I'm just so happy to see someone who is not trying to return worn pants without a receipt that I'm willing to go along with pretty much whatever she says. After all, Freud did not say you need to love your work, only that you need both. Consider this. States where workers report being the happiest, like Colorado, Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, and Arizona, all rank in the top half of states for divorce rates. And the states with the unhappiest workers, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, all place in the bottom third of divorce rates. And yeah, it's hard to draw scientific conclusions here, but being satisfied with your job probably means you're going to spend more time there. Naturally, this leaves less time to love your loved ones. And maybe those of us with jobs we hate are more likely to cultivate the other areas of our life that bring us joy. I do know one thing. Next time you're out shopping for a shirt or a tie, and you see the guy behind the counter with a far-off look in his eye, know that he's not trying to be rude. It's just that, for him, work may be nothing more than waiting to go home.
That's Alan Staples, who reminds us that kind of a crappy job can be okay, as long as you're getting some loving.
That's from our In the Loop show back in March called Are You Your Job? Those were listeners of the show who keep up on show topics through our website and email list. You can learn all about us and sign up for that email list at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Sometimes getting the right perspective means going outside our immediate network. This was certainly true for a show we did a little while back on homelessness. In fact, we picked up and moved our whole show down the block from Minnesota Public Radio to the Dorothy Day Center, a shelter in downtown St. Paul. One of the people that we met there was a poet named Angelo Mack. Angelo, thanks for coming, man.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're going to read a poem for us that's called Dead on My Feet. And when you read it for me, it gave me such a crystal clear idea, I think, of where we wanted to go with this show that I'm really glad to have you here to start it off.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I lie in a place with very little space. Snoring in the background, coughing, sneezing, crunching bags, bickering fights, make it hard to sleep throughout the night. Now, it's way past 10 before my sleep set in, and it's 5 a.m. I have to do it all again. Dogs get better night's sleep, and it's a dog life when you're walking on these streets. I rise at best with very little rest. Head for the chapel, there it said, you can find peace and rest. Always the welcome guest. So I roll under the pew to catch a few, just to close my eyes and hear, hey you, service is through. With no sleep, dead on my feet, I march on to Sally's. Along the way, I peep out an alley, dreaming of refuge and wish to sleep. Hoping this is the benefit that I'll reap, because it ain't easy walking the streets. Bags under my arms, bags under my eyes, as big as Samson Knight, last to sleep, first to rise. Roars in the background, horns honking, sirens blaring, screeching of tires, above the bridge from which I crawl. Got no sleep, too afraid the damn thing might fall. Dead on my feet in stealth mode, try to sneak past a camera in a hall. And it was only moments later the security got called. So dead on my feet, I'm tired as I try to debate it. The situation only got the man frustrated. And it didn't take much, so now I got irritated. Unlike before, when my judgment wasn't as poor, now decisions are cloudy. I find myself talking loud in a vain attempt to hold my head proudly. Dead on my feet, it's too easy to fuss. It's too easy to cuss. Always ready to fight. Longer are the days and shorter is the nights. Uneventfully is the plan. Each other understands that the other man is walking dead on his feet. Hostility from lack of sleep. So we show no remorse, no real concern, and yet we learn for a good night's rest. So tomorrow we could be at our best. With that, thank you.
That poem by Angelo Mack was from a show we did at the Dorothy Day Homeless Shelter in St. Paul called Getting By and Getting Out. You're listening to a special episode of In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're taking a look back at the past year. It's kind of a reintroduction to who we are and what we're about as we launch into our new season, starting next week. Now, along with me, one of the other voices on the show a lot in the past year was producer Sandon Totten. We sent Sandon out to report on all kinds of stories, like why people don't vote, what it's like to live a life of protest, and how to get fake immigration documents in the Twin Cities. His stories demonstrate the values of our show: healthy skepticism, intense curiosity, and the voices of real people. Consider what happened when we sent Sandon to learn about how environmental we are in the Twin Cities for a show called Getting Past Green. Truth be told, there are lots of reasons to celebrate. This is a pretty green place, all in all. But Sandon's report gives a much more complex image of where we really stand.
When it comes to the environment, we all like to think we do our part. For most people, that means one thing.
I recycle and do things like that.
We recycle and all that stuff.
I definitely recycle.
And in Minnesota, that's more than just lip service. Minnesotans have an unusually high recycling rate, 41% of their total trash. That makes Minnesota the second best in the nation when it comes to recycling, just a hair behind Oregon. And that's something to be proud of, but it's hardly the whole picture. There's a blemish on Minnesota's Eco Report card. You only have to look a few feet from your recycling bin to see what it is. It's garbage.
So the bad news is that we continue to create more waste each year.
That's Mark Rust, the garbage guru for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He says, in spite of all the recycling, Minnesotans continue to throw out more junk every year. Last year's average was 1.17 tons per person. Imagine a Volkswagen Beetle with a family of four inside and their pets. That's roughly the weight of the trash tossed out by each Minnesotan every year. It's slightly less than the U.S. average of 1.3 tons per person, but it's still almost double what countries like Japan or the United Kingdom produce.
I still would say that we're a throwaway society. People have busy lives, and how they manage their garbage, I mean, I don't think it's even on the radar screen.
But to make headway on global warming and pollution, Mark says it's going to take more than good recycling habits. We need to change how we think about almost every aspect of our lives. If that's the case, then the city of Minneapolis is ahead of the curve. Minneapolis is frequently ranked one of the 10 greenest U.S. cities by national magazines and organizations. Not only does it boast a first-class recycling program, but over the last 5 years, it actually managed to reduce its garbage. It's a national leader when it comes to green roofs, and it gets more of its energy from renewable resources than any other Midwestern city. For Minneapolis resident Gary Hoover, those facts are encouraging. The environment figures into almost everything he does, from the food he eats to the way he gets around the city. You see, Gary drives an SUV.
But it's different than sport utility vehicle. This is called a sensible utility vehicle because it doesn't burn any gas.
It's essentially a giant tricycle with a bench on the back. It can haul up to 800 pounds. Gary uses his trike to carry tools and building supplies. He's a green handyman. He took me for a ride around South Minneapolis on his human-powered vehicle. He says traveling this way gives him a different perspective.
The trees are gorgeous. There's some snow kind of gilding the tops of the branches, and it's just a lovely day. The one thing that oftentimes spoils the day is car exhaust. That's another ironic thing is because I pedal, I work hard, so I breathe hard. And I really inhale that exhaust. It makes me feel like I'm being punished for doing a good thing.
Gary may feel alone on the road, but when it comes to sustainable action, he's got some good company. Around 7:30 every morning, Deb and Doug Pierce sit down over coffee and lay out the day's battle plan.
Maybe I should set up another meeting through the Yahoo groups.
Now, do you think you'll engage more people that way as opposed to, you know, them coming to a meeting?
For the Pierces, living green isn't enough. They want others to go green as well. They sit on boards, chair committees, and speak publicly about the need for eco action in Minnesota. Deb says it wasn't that long ago that people were clueless about global warming. Now, it's front page news.
I wanted to take the newspaper the last 2 days and run around, you know, all the neighborhood meetings with it. Look! Look!
People in her neighborhood are starting to get it. Deb feels like a tipping point is coming.
We're getting there. We're getting very, very close. It only takes 20 to 25% of the people to be solid behind something to turn the tide. That's it. That's all it takes.
But even in a green city like Minneapolis, where people are doing their part, car commuting is on the rise. The average driver is spending 43 hours a year burning gas in traffic. And while Minneapolis has managed to cut down its energy use, the state's numbers as a whole are going up. When all is said and done, Minnesota is pumping 146 million tons of greenhouse gases into the air every year. Gary Hoover admits he sometimes feels overwhelmed.
And I have to tell myself, you know, I can't control what other people do, but I can control much of what I do, and so that's what I have to focus on.
But that's the fundamental dilemma. Folks like Gary and the Pierces, they may be doing their part. Even whole cities like Minneapolis are making strides. But in the face of a culture with so many built-in bad habits, depending on individuals to go green, may not be enough.
That was a story from Sandin Totten. Sandin remains one of the producers for our upcoming season of In the Loop, so you'll be hearing lots more of him in the next few weeks. I'm Jeff Horwich, the host of In the Loop. Now, one vital element of our shows is great reported pieces like that one. They don't just lay out the facts, they take you deeper and make you think. We like to approach the music in the same way. Now, as classes were letting out this spring, we took on a show called What I Really Learned in School. When it came time to dive into some history, we couldn't help but be inspired by that staple of our childhood, Schoolhouse Rock.
Your schoolhouse rocking, what's your bump and bump? On your favorite head, schoolhouse rock.
Jimmy, time to get up and go to school.
Aw, man, do I have to?
Absolutely, young man.
Hate stupid school. What's the point of school anyway?
Hello, Jimmy.
Who the heck are you? What'd you do to my bedroom?
Why, I'm Horace Mann.
The flute player?
No, that's Herbie Mann. I'm Horace Mann, often called the father of American education. And I've come from the 19th century to help you understand why you need to get your butt on that school bus.
Don't wanna.
Well, Jimmy, it's not about you. Schools were designed with something much bigger in mind. The national economy.
What?
Well, let me grab this guitar-like instrument here and take you on a little musical journey through history, Jimmy.
Oh, man.
Well, let me take you back, Jimmy, to the founding of the nation. Most American children got a private education. Parents at home, preachers at church, however they felt the groove. It was hard to control and inefficient for a nation on the move. Oh, well, Jimmy, let me introduce you to a man I'm sure you know. Thomas Jefferson had some thoughts on how to make the system grow.
We need two kinds of schools to help our nation be its best. One for a small group of future leaders, another for the rest.
Different systems for the learned and the laborers. That's what Jefferson said.
Gosh, I didn't know he said that.
Well, history is not your best subject, Jimmy. That's why you're in that second category. Oh, well, you know you gotta go to school so you can grow up and get a job. Big economies need worker bees, not another lazy slob. The nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Golly, was school really designed around me being just some cog in the economy?
Well, think about it this way. We created a school system that trains you to respect authority, complete busy work you don't like, and hop to it at the sound of the bell. We even created evenings and summers off so kids can help out with the family business or farm.
Wow, a vestige of the agrarian society.
Whoa, let's be careful with those big words, Jimmy. You know the year was 1840, and the cities were overflowing. Immigrants came by the thousands, you see, and the need for schools was growing. While I was in charge in Massachusetts for a while, we led the way. We made sure those children were productive with their day. Yes, industrialists like Rockefeller offered some reflections. They weighed in with their money and political connections.
A school should teach kids order, to obey without a sound. We don't need more poets, artists, and philosophers around.
So you gotta go to school so you can grow up and go to work. A big factories need worker bees, not some artsy-fartsy jerk. You know the nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Now, wait a minute. It's not like my teachers never encouraged me to be creative or have an opinion.
Well, of course there's a lot of room for flexibility, but we're still mostly stuck with this system forged during the Industrial Revolution. And if you don't believe me, take it from Andrew Carnegie.
Yep.
And there are more modern developments that reinforce our instinct to see schools as essentially workforce preparation centers.
Like the Smith-Hughes Act of 1917, which establishes schools as a federally funded locations of vocational training?
Well, I think somebody's been cheating. Well, Jimmy, the year was 1983, and a new report we got put our students up against the world, and they didn't look so hot. The economy was in recession. How could we compete? The Japanese were kicking our butts back and forth across the street. Well, enter the age of testing, a new desire to standardize. You could tell the students dug it from the glaze upon their eyes. There'd be no child left behind, they all had to measure up. Math and science is the mantra to win the economic cup. Yes, Jimmy, you got to go to school so you can grow up and take your place. Future companies need worker bees who can help us win the race. Come on, the nation needs a workforce, and schools have to provide. So you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride. That's right, you know you gotta get up and go to school so you can take your place with pride.
Jimmy!
Aw, you made me miss the bus.
I got some help there on that one from actress Robin Johnson as Jimmy and Joe Weissman as various historical voices. Joe is the bass player for our house band on the show called The Smarts. The other guys are Morris Engel on drums and Jimmy Kennedy on keys. You could hear the three of them backing me up there on that song. They'll be with us this fall, adding their smart musical touches to In the Loop each week. You can learn more about them at thesmartsband.com. As you could hear, we taped the show with a live studio audience here in St. Paul. You can get free tickets for any of our upcoming shows at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. While you're there, you can get on our email list, subscribe to our podcast, and you can download previous episodes. Now, while we do a lot of music on the show, if we're doing our jobs well, the whole show has a musical feel to it. Think about the music you can get from the voices of two people telling a story. We had a great example of that during our show about personal experiences with crime. Producer Curtis Gilbert brought us a story about two friends, Brian Miller and Django Amerson. They were mugged together outside Brian's apartment building. It was a Friday night, little past midnight, and they were pulling into the parking lot. The story starts with what happened to Brian.
We drive past these two guys, and I totally ignored them. Django apparently didn't. And we backed into a parking spot, and we both got out. And we were talking over the roof of the car, and then the next thing I knew, there was a gun in my back, and this guy was like, "I'm gonna shoot you. Put your, you know, give me everything you got." And got really scared and afraid I was gonna die, and only had $15 in my wallet, and so I gave him the wallet, and really, really hoped that they went away.
I did not see the wallet change hands. I didn't see the gun at that point. They were kids. They were very young. And I just thought it seemed positive.
What could they have possibly been doing with me that was positive?
Asking you for directions or...
Friendly scuffle for directions.
I walked up and I just said, "What's going on? What's going on here? What's happening?" And then I saw the gun. And it rattled when the guy shook it. I don't know how else to describe it, because immediately... the first thing that went through my mind was, this is very clearly not a real gun.
We reacted to the situation in very different ways.
Yeah.
I was pretty much emptying my bowels into my pants in fear and dread. And then this guy walks around the car and is like, "Hey, what do you guys got there?"
I asked the guy with the gun, I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Yeah, you give me all your expletive, you." And I said, "Hold on, that's not a real gun. You know that, and I know that." And he's like, "What, you don't think this is real?" And I said, "No, I know it's not real." And so I said, "If it's a real gun..." And we were right up by the entrance to the building. So in effect, there's a wooden wall right next to us where the mugging took place. And I said, "If it's a real gun, go ahead and shoot a hole right there, and I'll give you the money that's in my wallet."
You have to say, while you were saying this, you were like stepping up to the guy. I mean, it wasn't like you guys were having like a civilized discourse. It's like you were bumping chests, and the one guy was like, "I'm gonna f-ing kill you," and the other guy was like, do it, shoot it.
They kind of started leaving, getting nervous and creeping away. And what happened was, as a literal parting shot, he literally punched me with the gun. He threw the gun up to my head and pulled the trigger at the same instant that it that it both slammed into my skull and he pulled the trigger. It was just like a sound, and my head just got rocked to the side.
It looked like they just punched you and you fell over, to me.
I just was like, whoa, and totally disoriented for a good 5 seconds. And Brian was like, are you okay? And he didn't, and I was like, man, I got shot in the head. You know, in my mind, I'm going, man, and I'm alive. This is crazy. I must be bleeding or something.
My perspective was that two guys with a real gun that could have killed us had mercy upon us and just punched you in the head and ran away.
It was probably a double effect of the impact of a gun, like being pistol whipped, and the brand of the gun, which I think was Daisy, which is a which is an air-powered pellet gun, the CO2 cartridge, which luckily, I guess, you know, very luckily, it didn't have a pellet. But I was totally up for chasing those guys down just on foot, then decided against it and kind of just slumped down in the parking lot and waited for the cops to come. In retrospect, I feel a person ought to operate off a list of priorities. And I mean, what is a wallet compared to, even if it's a pellet gun, I mean, it could have been loaded. Who knows? I mean, I'm touching the side of my face right now, and I mean, there's skin that I want there. What if you put it up to my eyeball socket and pulled the trigger? That would kill you. Yes, a pellet gun can kill you if it goes into your eye, because it'll go straight through your eye into your brain, and you will die.
We're fundamentally different people in some ways in this situation. I've thought a lot about whether or not I would, like, kick someone in the balls if they did this again, or, like, try to do something like that, but I don't know. I think I'd be too afraid that they'd shoot me.
I'm more scared now than as it happened, for sure. I wonder if deep down I'm some sort of weird macho person. I'm trying to figure that out right now, assess it. I don't know where it came from and why. You know, so as I look back on it, I go, oh, man, I really screwed up. I mean, that's dumb. It's just dumb. And my neck is still very, very sore, possibly avoided by just forking over the wallet.
Our thanks to Brian Miller and Django Amerson. Producer Curtis Gilbert brought us that story. I'm Jeff Horwich. We're midway through our guided tour of In the Loop. Our show is about to make the jump from monthly to weekly. This fall, you'll be able to catch the show on the radio Sunday nights at 6, with a rebroadcast Wednesday nights at 9. On the cusp of our big growth spurt, we thought now would be a good moment to revisit some of our favorite material, give you a fresh introduction to who we are and what we're all about. One of the areas where you'll definitely know In the Loop is a little different from the rest of public radio is in our interviews. We love finding surprising people to get us into a topic, and we love interviews that don't always go where you'd expect them to. One of our favorites was about 1 year ago. As you may recall, there was an election coming up. Now, our show doesn't dwell on politics. Lord knows you get enough of that everywhere else you turn. But when we do deal with politics, we like to do it in our own style. A good example comes from the show we did just after that election last year. Overnight, Republicans and Democrats went from years of name-calling and fear-mongering to a kind of political campfire sing-along. The camp counselors leading the chorus are President Bush and new Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
It is now our duty to put the elections behind us and work together with the Democrats and independents on the great issues facing this country. I told Congresswoman Pelosi that I look forward to working with her and her colleagues to find common ground in the next 2 years.
And we will do so, working together with the administration and the Republicans in Congress in partnership, not in partisanship.
Now, Bush and Pelosi are hardly the first couple to try to make amends with each other. Dave Decker would know.
Actually, it parallels all too closely situations that I've seen in my practice.
Decker is a psychotherapist who works with troubled couples and anger management. He says the fatal temptation in a crumbling relationship or a divided government is
power. And how is power handled? When one party or the other gains control, they use the power to deal with old grudges, old feuds, and so it's time to punish and get retribution.
If you had, say, President Bush and Nancy Pelosi here on your couch, where would you even begin with them to try and smooth things over?
I don't think they'd come to my couch. I don't know that they'd come to anyone's couch.
Well, not quite. They can certainly come to ours.
George and Nancy, welcome to your first counseling session.
Before we begin, I want you to know that by just being here, you are showing your commitment to make this relationship work. George, do you understand why Nancy made this appointment for the two of you to see me today?
You think I'm nuts? You think my sensibilities left me?
No, it's not that at all. Nancy thought that by talking through your problems with me, we can bring the two of you even closer together.
The oversight will be very important because then the truth would be revealed.
Thank you, Nancy. But let's try to use positive language. George, are you with us?
This isn't, as we said, this isn't my first rodeo.
Okay. George, can you remember some of the things Nancy has said recently? Things that have hurt you?
I must confess I cannot catalog for you in detail the different criticisms.
Well then, Nancy, do you remember what you might have said to George
that
may...
Oblivious. In denial. Dangerous.
Yes. George, how does that make you feel?
Are you bringing this up so everybody else gets kind of jealous?
Let's move on. George, can you remember some of the hurtful things you've said to Nancy?
That kind of question is the kind of thing that causes one to... You know, I really haven't... It's tough in a time of war.
I would say that it's the same old on the part of the president. He has no answer to the question.
Nancy, I think we need to talk for a moment about your attitude.
What about it?
Well, we need to keep it positive.
We have never heard a clear plan from this administration, and we did not hear one tonight.
No, I knew you'd probably try to get me to start negotiating with myself.
Okay, I'm not totally sure you're both really committed to doing this.
We're here about the future. That's where our priorities are.
Well, I am glad to hear that. George, do you think you can spend some time over the next week considering what we talked about today?
I'm trying to get the Indian deal done, the Vietnam deal done, and the budget's done. But I'll take a look at it.
Good. Nancy?
The president got the message, thank heavens. And I think it signals a new change, I hope.
Well, that's all for today. Good luck, you two, and God bless America.
That In the Loop political insight is from back in November, just after the elections. Looks like our skepticism about that relationship turned out to be well-placed. Thanks to Greta Cunningham for playing therapist to our sniping political couple. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. This hour is about reintroducing ourselves before we start a brand new season of shows next week. On In the Loop, we love looking in new ways at things we all take for granted. Take Christmas lights, for example. As part of our show last year on Christmas Eve, we tried to look past the glimmer and think about what it costs us as individuals and as a society to drive away the darkness that time of year. To start off, I went out to visit holiday light superstar Jerry Fink.
Well, up on the hill there, we have the manger scene. Three wise men, the shepherd, the sheep, the donkey.
They all light up.
And the camels, yes, they all light up.
Jerry walks from outlet to outlet, bringing his yard to life in South St. Paul. Dozens of fans start blowing, and lumps of canvas lurch upward from the lawn.
Looks like everything's starting to move.
Your whole yard's coming to life here.
Yeah.
Got SpongeBob over there and the Nutcracker.
Outside of that, I have 135 plastic figurines. Each one lights up.
Any idea how many bulbs are involved in the whole project?
We have right around 15,000 we counted up.
Jerry's holiday spirit comes at a price. He figures he's got about $8,000 in decorations. It takes him 100 hours to string all the lights. And for the first time last year, Jerry actually ran the numbers on how much power he was using.
Our power consumption was running us around $500 for the season, extra on our bill.
Now, with 15,000 bulbs and an army of inflatables, Jerry makes the papers. Buses and limos pass by on tours. But for every Jerry Fink, there are thousands of more modest displays drawing extra power from the grid. Like, for example, mine. I'm standing in the soft glow of my house, in the cold, and I'm going to do something I don't usually do here in my front yard, math. Now, across my front awning this year, I've got two strings of icicle lights with 300 mini bulbs each. Inside my front porch are another two strings. Our Christmas tree lives on the porch, too, with maybe 300 lights on it. So we're talking 1,500 half-watt bulbs. My timers keep them lit 7 hours a day, so that's about 250 hours from Thanksgiving to New Year's, when I think I'm going to take them down. Right now, my power company charges 7.2 cents per kilowatt hour. So you add all this up,
And we're talking $13.50 for the whole season. Well, that seems like a pretty small price to pay for all this Christmas joy.
But what about pollution? My power company makes 83% of its electricity from coal and natural gas. This is pretty standard for the U.S. Coal puts out 2 pounds of carbon dioxide for every kilowatt hour of electricity. Gas, about 1 pound. Apply these ratios, and it turns out my modest display of holiday spirit accounts for 252 additional pounds of carbon dioxide Santa and his reindeer get to fly through on the way to my rooftop. Turns out that's not as much CO2 as I spew from my tailpipe burning one tank of gas as I tool around town looking for the perfect gift. But with global warming a generally accepted fact, those extra contributions this time of year do add up. Putting aside the massive commercial and municipal displays, let's say 1 in 20 U.S. households had a display as large as mine. That's $75 million of electricity and 1.4 billion pounds of carbon dioxide. And to be thorough, there is one more cost worth asking about. Light pollution, which can confuse nocturnal animals and dulls our view of the night sky. That matters a lot to some people.
I'm Josh Nolenberg. I'm an astronomer, and that means basically I study levels of light.
So tell me about the little tool that we're carrying with us here tonight.
Well, basically it's a light sensor. When I point it at an object that's giving off some light, it'll tell us exactly how much light is coming from that object.
So we're standing here in St. Paul's Rice Park before a Christmas tree that is said to have 50,000 lights on it. Should we try and get a measurement?
Let's do it. Got 20.6 microwatts.
Now, can you put that in context for me? What is 20.6 microwatts?
Well, it's not a lot of power, but keep in mind that's power from the photons that are coming from the tree itself.
So this tree is covered with 50,000 colored bulbs. There are trees all over the park that are strung with thousands and thousands of white bulbs in a spot that otherwise would be pretty dim this time of night. Should we care about that at all?
Well, there is a lot of light pollution already, and it's that diffuse orange glow that you see over cities. The holiday lights do add to that, but on the other hand, certain types of lights are better than others.
Our astronomer is a fan of LED Christmas lights, which are getting a big commercial push this year. While the standard incandescents throw their light off in all directions, LEDs are directional, which means if they're set up in a mindful way, much less light escapes up into the sky, where no one can enjoy it anyway. LED lights are also a revolution on the electricity front. Each bulb gives more light with just a fraction of the power used by an incandescent. Jerry Fink, the homeowner from a few minutes ago, is starting to make the switch and hoping it'll make a big dent in his $500 power charge. But LED strings are pricey, more than a dollar per foot. It'll be some time before they replace the bargain lights most people still use. So what is an environmentally conscious holiday light addict to do? I called up a particularly conspicuous homeowner, Alec Komernitsky, in Boulder, Colorado.
What I have, Jeff, is 15,000 Christmas lights and several inflatables. And I've got 3 webcams that people on the Internet can not only view those Christmas lights and decorations, they can actually control them. They can turn them on and off with a click of a mouse.
Alec soothes his conscience by paying extra to his power company to support wind energy. And each holiday season, he calculates his carbon emissions and makes a compensating donation toward alternative energy research.
I mean, I don't want to raise the flag and say I'm such a great guy, blah, 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 I'm Al Gore's buddy or whatever. But I don't know, I just thought it was kind of a good thing to do.
Alec has also used his website to raise more than $15,000 for research into an autoimmune disease that affects his 2 sons. Apparently, his lights put people in a giving mood. So, in the end, there is no easy way to complete the math equation on holiday lights. We can measure the cost in dollars, carbon, or adding to the dull orange glow that surrounds our cities and towns. But until someone figures out a scientific measurement for holiday cheer and the goodwill it inspires, the benefits will be much more difficult to pin down. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich. Thanks for joining us on this kind of get-to-know-you episode of In the Loop. We're about to kick off a new season starting next week, and we want you to be a part of it. You can join our studio audience. We tape the show here at Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday nights. You can join our growing network of collaborators who help us build the show with your stories and ideas. And you can listen on the radio Sunday nights at 6 with a rebroadcast Wednesday nights at 9. Podcast subscribers will get the show a couple days early. Check into all of this at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. We started out this hour talking about this network of listeners and collaborators we have on In the Loop. It's amazing the kind of experience and talent we can tap just by connecting with new friends here in Minnesota. One of those is Lorena Duarte. Lorena is a captivating slam poet from Minneapolis. When the topic of immigration came up on the show, we asked her to compose something new to help us think about the issue.
There once was a man named John Doe Jr., a suburbanite, a good man, a knee-jerk consumer. Jr. left his house on Monday thinking, man, what a bummer, I hate Mondays. But hey, it's May, it's getting warm, it's almost summer. I'll go out on the lake in my sweet new boat, I can fish for some walleye, I can put away my coat. And after work, I'll go check on our brand new house, it's almost ready. 4 bedrooms, jacuzzi, a fake waterfall feature that flows and eddies. Junior drove and drove, stopped by Mickey D's for his cup of morning joe and egg McMuffin with no cheese. But wait, the drive-thru is packed. What's going on? He says, I'm stuck like a veal in a line that's ridiculously long. Cars in the front of him, cars in the back, and all the manager can say is, my fry guys must still be in the sack. Though later than usual, he's still the first one at work. Typical, he mutters, as he opens the door with a jerk. But, hey, what's going on? It's locked. The janitors usually come before everyone, clean up and leave before 7 o'clock. The halls aren't vacuumed, the wastebasket's full, the bathroom's not cleaned, and Junior thinks, man, this is all bull! Later for lunch, he thinks, what could perk up my day? A Chipotle burrito, and he is out on his way. He walks the downtown streets quickly. His tummy is rumbling and gets there, but no, it can't be. He's soon reduced to a lump of bumbling, jumbling, and mumbling. What's going on? Where are my burritos? My sour cream? We've all gone to hell, and I'm stuck in a bad, bad dream. We're not in hell. This is a bemused little voice. It's Anita, the manager, a good woman of choice. She always hooks Junior up with extra guacamole. She's nice and quick and always really, really funny. First McDonald's, then the janitors, and now you guys. What next? Is Starbucks gonna run out of chais? Anita purses her lips, says, don't you follow the news? Mira, Juanito, today's May 1st. Haven't you heard? Latinos aren't working today to say we're fed up. No more puerile demagogues. We are not your slaving cogs. Wow, man, Anita, what the hell does that mean? Says Junior, who's never seen her seem quite so keen. It means, Juanito, that we are sick and tired of politicians who, to get elected, keep saying that we are so different from you. They treat Latinos like piñatas, beating us and causing a fuss till the votes come flying out. It makes me want to cuss. So, why are you here then today? Says Junior, at this point beyond utterly confused. I made a deal, Anita says. I come so the others won't get abused. I still don't get it, says Junior. I don't understand the whole deal. Why the border jumping? It seems like they've come to steal. Look, Juanito, my boy, America's got an aging population. Without immigrants, you will lose your place among nations. Look at the numbers. Look at the facts. Let's get them straight before you give people the axe. There's very few ways for immigrants to enter without millions, that is, or without presidential connections. We only want to be treated like other immigrant groups. We aren't demanding special treatment. We pay our taxes, and we are not a bunch of crooks. I mean, as I always say, double dipping isn't fair. You can't tell us to go home and then complain when we're not there. Wow, Anita. How do you know all this stuff? Oh, I was economics major at the University of Guanajuato. Man, says Junior, now you work here? That's kind of tough. Yeah, such is life. So how about some day-old chips and guac? No, thanks, replies Junior. Maybe I'll just go take a walk, but hey, one more thing, my guac-slinging teacher. My new house, today, the roof, the sheetrock, his lip quivers, my waterfall feature. Nope, Juanito. Best go home and turn on the news. Get out of the utopian void and figure out your own views. Junior steps out of the restaurant, takes a deep breath to clear his head. Latinos. Important. Huh, he said.
That was Lorena Duarte, one of the collaborators and friends of our show who helped keep things interesting. We welcome you to join that list. Just go to minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop and click to join our network. I'm Jeff Horwich, and before we finish up, we'll make one last stop on our In the Loop tour. Our show is devoted to exploring what's on people's minds and confronting the issues of the day in our own style. We're also devoted to having fun and poking fun at the world around us. This was certainly on the agenda this spring when we looked at our modern culture of protest in a show called To Take a Stand. Let's face it, it's not easy nowadays when there really is so much to protest.
Watch the world slip by me so easily, never caring what was right or wrong. Now I got the bug, I'm feeling warm and smug, I know where I belong. So much to protest, so little time. Somebody point me to a picket line. Just so many ways to speak my mind. So much to protest, so little time. Whoa! My home computer helped me find my voice. Email petitions are my tool of choice. Type your name, click send, do it over again. There really ain't nothing to it. Sure, it's tough, my inbox is stuffed, but somebody's got to do it. Send a form letter to my senator. Yo, to make the point, I send it 10 times more. Hey. So much to protest, so little time. I'm blogging everything that's on my mind. I'm Abby Hoffman when I go online. Yeah. So much to protest, so little time. Rise up, consumers, this is our hour. The message we're sending with the dollars we're spending has so much power. I won't touch the Walmart in my neighborhood, no, no. Shopping at Target and it feels so good. We can change the world with what we buy at the store, like a new bumper sticker or anything by Michael Moore. Yeah. So much to protest, so little time. I know the Al Gore movie line by line. Watch the Daily Show, that should let you know revolution is on my mind. So much to protest, so little time. Here we go. Stop the war, support the troops, influence of interest groups, a dollar for genocide, organics with a pesticide, a hospital beds, money for schools. When they fired those attorneys, did they follow the rules? Got to live green, sex on TV, FBI's with me at the library. Got to free Tibet, nukes underground. Why is Sanjaya Malakar still hanging around? Homeless jobless people, civil unions, healthcare costs are still ballooning. Deadbeat dads, hanging chads, whoa, whoa. What's with all those Geico ads? Social Security, lockbox, dirty bombs, smallpox, Hillary, Obama, tell me where the hell's Osama? Immigration, wage inflation, fast food nation, constipation, everybody's worried about neighborhood crime. How do you start to do your part? Yeah, so much to protest, so little time. Yeah,
so much to protest, so little time.
So much to protest,
so much to protest, so little time.
Here we go.
So much to protest, so little time.
Well, there you have it. That hour hardly captures all we've done on In the Loop, of course, much less the possibilities waiting for us over the next couple months. But I hope our show feels a little less like that random acquaintance you bump into every now and then, and a little more like the beginning of a friendship. We'll tape the first episode of our new fall season here at Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday night. We're calling it Your Exposed Life, an examination of those digital trails of information we all drag behind us now thanks to the internet. And in the following show, called Democracy, Is It In You?, we'll look at democratic experiments in our own lives and see if this idea of spreading democracy is really all it's cracked up to be. You can get tickets for these or any future tapings on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. You can also join our email list if you want to keep up with the show topics we've got in the works and share your stories and ideas to help us build those episodes. Of course, you can listen to In the Loop right here Sunday nights at 6 or by subscribing to our podcast. In the end, this show is really about you, and it will be stronger with each person who joins in the process. I'm Jeff Horwich. I'll be your host through it all. Thanks for welcoming In the Loop to your public radio world. Are you ready? We'll see you soon.